messages you are getting from the book, and I was wondering this morning how many of these I completely agree with. Well, one of the first things you're getting is a very good understanding. Scott does very, very well with that, with the entire biology of fertilization and reproduction, right? And he goes out of his way to show how many mythologies that have been generated about it. In particular, how the extent to which we, and we are not the only ones, every society does this, where certain views about society as a whole leads to an interpretation of scientific facts in a certain way, which reflects nothing other than the societal superstructure, what our ideas of the good and functioning society are. The classic one is this continuous reference to sperm competition, right? As to what exactly happens when all the sperm enter the vagina, then the uterus, make their way up the fallopian tubes where they're drawn in, right? If an egg happens to be present, they're drawn in, and then a rather complex process. The sperm does not penetrate the egg. The sperm goes, and it's a sort of almost like a lock and key fit, sits next to the surface, and the surface is melt by a very, very common process, and it's like two cells merging with each other, one of which is very small, and the other that is much larger, which is the egg cell. Everybody with me? Sperm competition is not something that goes on. One point that Scott does not mention, and I was talking to him after the class last time, in the next edition he will, there is an odd way in which, as far as we know, and I am a little more confident that this is right than he is in terms of the experimental data, that there is some aspects of the female's physiology that can contribute towards controlling the sex of the embryo, and that is that depending on how acidic, right, the intrauterine environment is, sperm that have the Y chromosome rather than the X chromosome survive differentially. Everybody with me? One consequence of this is that that older females should on the average have more female offspring than younger ones. I've been collecting data for the last week to see whether I can back this up. This is not my hypothesis. This hypothesis has been around for a long time, but nobody has sifted through the data to see whether this obvious prediction turns out to be correct, and if not, whether there are complications because of which we can't test it this way. Everybody with me? Okay. All right. And then fertilization takes place. Where I don't completely agree with Scott and all of that is I think they harp a bit too much on social problems of the new artificial reproductive technologies and also the IVF and all of that compared to the good. What you really need here is a cost-benefit analysis. If they're coming out and saying that before couples attempt to use any of these ARTs, right, assisted reproductive technologies, and in particular IVFs, they need to be warned as to how low the chances of success are, right? And they need to be also told what the economic cost is so they can plan properly. Everybody with me? I agree with them on that. But it's undeniably the case that lots and lots of people who want children have been able to conceive their own children, right, than they had in the past. And overall, it seems to me that the benefits outweigh the costs quite remarkably in this case. But then I'm probably more of a technological optimist than Scott Gilbert ever has been. No wonder he lives in Oregon with all the hippies there. Okay, yeah. But I do have some faith in this technology. Now, anything else I want to say about that before I turn to human development and what we know about it and what we don't know about it and what that tells us about any of our so to say, societal normative concerns about the desirability, legality, and all of that of abortions and stuff like that. No, not really. I think the book as a whole does not spend enough time on talking about what the psychological response of both a female and sometimes even the male response is to the process of reproduction and things of that sort. At one point, it talks a bit about whether or not a female ovulates depends on the psychological stage of a female. That deserved a lot more emphasis than the book had. In fact, probably, I don't know if all of you know this. How many of you know the fact that every time that there is some remarkable or very high degree of problems, social problems, uncertainty in a society, the birth rate goes down? How many of you know this or have heard this? Just a few of you. The evidence is very compelling. The last case being Russia, at the time when there was really a lot of uncertainty after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the birth rate completely declines. Now, some of you might say, in some cases, and it used to be believed in most cases, this happened because in general nutrition declined and things of that sort, and poor nutrition can lead to all kinds of ovulation problems, but we know that's not the answer. Stress introduces hormonal responses that act against ovulation. Yeah? Stress can also trigger a miscarriage, and there's been high stress.
In California, there was a post 9/11 study that was done on pregnant Muslim women, and they saw that, like, since Muslims were suddenly become like a public enemy, a lot of women experienced miscarriages
post 9/11. Yeah, I don't know that data, but it wouldn't surprise me that there were responses of that kind. Things like that have been known elsewhere. Yeah. Yes, though there have been surveys done as to whether or not they are having sex, and the surveys that, if assuming people are responding to those surveys honestly, which is always a problem when you have sex-related surveys all the way to Masters and Johnson, assuming they're responding to it, that does not explain the whole effect. It might explain part of it, but the real evidence comes from the fact is that there have been measurements done on hormonal levels, physiological measurements. And that might be a correlation, but whatever it is, assuming that link is causal, the link between that and not ovulating is also understood in terms of a causal mechanism. But I don't think there's only one pathway. All of these things are playing a role in situations like this. And I guess, Clara, Scott's co-author, when she was supposed to deal with all the social and other problems associated with different aspects of fertility, infertility, and all of that. And she focuses entirely on psychological issues, mainly connected with infertility. I would have focused more on society-wide responses of what happens, so that would include all these issues about stress and things of that sort. Other things, female psychology changes during pregnancy, but more interestingly, some evidence to indicate that the females, because the change physiology leads to different kind of olfactory signals, that triggers off hormonal changes in males that are close to the females, and some fairly good evidence that men tend to put on weight during their partner's pregnancy. Okay, that's the level at which this endocrine stuff interactions go on, and after a lot of hesitation, I'm not including a discussion of endocrine disruption in this class just because there are too many topics to discuss. But the endocrine responses to things of this sort are quite important, and by now we realize socially quite relevant. They do talk about BPA and stuff like that, but there's a lot more than BPA that we have to worry about. All right, any questions about these first few chapters? Anything about the fertilization process that you find surprising? All right, test question to see whether or not you've been thinking. All right, the following. The book, and probably all the biology you know, simply comes out and tells you that what comes from the sperm is the nucleus, right? Heard all of that. What comes from the egg is the entire cytoplasm, in particular, the mitochondria. That's why if you track mitochondria, it's always going up to your mother, right, and all of that. And so you can, in this completely metaphorical sense, use mitochondria to trace back to the genetic makeup of the original Eve, at least at the mitochondrial level. Everybody with me? Scott also tells you in the book that the sperm, the whole sperm, gets absorbed inside the egg. Everybody with me? Now think of the egg. Now think of the sperm. What do you have there? You have a head in which you have a big nucleus and some enzymes outside the nucleus. It's almost a matter of taste as to whether you call those enzymes that are there outside the nucleus as part of a pretty rudimentary cytoplasm or not, but some of that. But the tail of sperm includes mitochondria. And it must, because the sperm needs energy in order to move around. The uterus does a lot to draw in the sperm, right? It sequentially has adhesive proteins that take the sperm further and further until they get into the fallopian tubes. And at some point, they bundle the sperm and keep the sperm there for a while to have the sperm mature. The sperm that emerges from the penis is not in a position to fertilize an egg. Everybody with me? Okay. So, for example, if somebody is carrying out IVF and gets sperm and semen out of a condom or wherever it is collected after ejaculation, they would have to treat the sperm to get it to the stage. Facilitation is what it's called. Get it to the stage before it can actually carry out fertilization with the egg, right? So it's doing a lot. But nevertheless, under normal, unassisted reproduction, the sperm has to be able to move in the uterus, in which case it needs energy, which is provided by the mitochondria, right? Now, if the entire sperm is being absorbed in the egg, these mitochondria are also being absorbed in the egg. So why don't you get any of the father's mitochondria inside the embryo? You work this out, it'll make you go and read stuff and try to figure this out. This is a perfect kind of, I think, a good kind of exam question, because it just makes you think about whether the picture that has been presented to you is complete. Everybody with me? What the question is I'm asking? Any question about that? Anything else? All right. Now that you've read, so how far have you read? Up to chapter 6? Yeah, okay. Up to chapter 6, I have a following question. So about 2 weeks ago, and I might have told you in class, sometimes I don't remember what I say in class, there was an editorial, I think in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, pointing out that how both people who are part of pro-choice movement and people who are both of the pro-life movement are turning more and more to science, right? And that is clarifying exactly what's happening scientifically through development would somehow tell you when abortion should become ethically impermissible and when it is permissible. And all of this is because it's supposed to provide you with a clue to when, right, the fertilized egg during the course of development, when the embryo becomes human, right? Or if you like, the embryo becomes a fetus, which actually is not identical to becoming a human. What's the answer? What can science tell you about it? It presumably tells you that the Bible was really crazy when God killed a man for masturbating, for spilling the seed in waste. God strikes him down. That God didn't know much biology. But beyond that, what does it tell you? How many of you knew the story from the Old Testament? Anybody? Only one. I should assign the Bible to the rest of the class. That would be good. That would really make you do a lot of reading before your next exam, if I made you responsible for all the books of the Old Testament. Can you imagine that? Especially all those chapters filled with X begat, Y begat, Z begat, A just goes on and on and on, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. It was required reading when I was an undergraduate, and it was one of the strangest readings I had to do. They didn't even pick up the highlights and the nice places with all the murders, rapes, and stuff. They made us read the whole damn thing. So now if only one person knew this story from the Bible, huh? I'm a little shocked. Yeah.
I've read other literature, like, you know, who wrote the Bible and stuff like that, and
Yeah, and what you have to worry now is that when you're looking at these particular East European societies, Hungary, Poland, and all of that, where populations are declining, whether that's driving all this legislation against abortion. Somehow, well, something is flipping, biologically is flipping at the social level, and in order to try to prevent the decline of their own population, they're trying to take control of reproductive technology in such a way, or choices in such a way, that it's always towards increasing the size of the population. Yeah, I mean, that could be operating. I mean, there are lots and lots of things about politics or religion that can be given functional explanations in that way, and they might well be valid. So what else? What's the message from the book about what science is going to tell you over the abortion debate? What does science say? Anybody? Do you think now that you understand the developmental process as accurately as you're supposed to understand it after reading these chapters, you're able to tell me what the ethics of abortion should be? Yeah.
I guess the book kind of highlights what we talked about a little earlier in class, but like the abortion debate when it comes to, for example, restricting the distribution of condoms is incorrect, just because like the book talks about just like how you talk about the sperm within the condom is not mature, or for example with like the morning after pill or Plan B, that the progesterone that's like released, it's not like the book defines pregnancy as once the fertilized embryo has attached itself to the uterine lining.
That's right. Pregnancy is implantation.
So that doesn't even take place if the like morning after pill or whatever is taken. So it's not as if you're like stopping pregnancy. It's like pregnancy doesn't happen at all at any of these steps until like the embryo has been like embedded in the morning.
Well, the morning after pill is even stronger than that, in the sense that it does not even prevent fertilization if the egg has actually formed. It prevents ovulation. And so part of the message there is it's people who try to say that it's preventing implantation are wrong. People who are trying to say that it's inducing abortion are completely wrong. But the most important message there is it's a really stupid form of contraception, because if the female has already ovulated, it'll do no good whatsoever. Okay, so it's about as completely ineffective if you're trying to plan your pregnancies. Okay, I mean, that was part of the message there. The book goes on. I mean, the real point being made here is that there is no consensus among scientists as whether or not there is a specific stage at which the embryo becomes human. Everybody with me? Okay. In particular, fertilization is not the same as pregnancy, right? And if you take fertilization to be when a human being is formed, then you have a real issue of trying to change social policy, right? In fact, you have to worry about the fact that 90% of human beings that are created end up being killed because naturally the fertilized cell does not succeed in getting into the, in implanting in the embryo. So you have real kinds of, I'm not saying what you should believe about these things. I'm going to just say a lot of if-then statements. That's what you end up with. If you take implantation, that might be the right thing to say, except you're sort of then committed to a point of view that being human just consists of being a certain kind of cells that are organized in more or less a spherical fashion, and that's what it is. Everybody with me? Now, if you're going by humanness corresponding to how death is defined in the medical context, by patterns of brain waves, then you're taken almost to the end of the second trimester. That's when it does, right? There are two problems here. None of these in any sense tell you it's a definitive stage at development, in the sense that there's a quantum jump here, right? From one status to another. The whole process is a gradual process of happening, right? Over there. The other one, of course, is nobody spends enough time saying, what does it mean to say something is human? Everybody with me? What is the definition that is being used? Okay. Before we begin to say, we want science to answer Well, when exactly during this process, somewhere in between fertilization and physical birth, right, a human being emerges. But what does it mean to say that a human being emerges? What does it? And I don't think there's any straightforward answer to that either. Okay. And certainly there's no scientific answer to that. Okay. Suppose, for example, you want a basic, right, mental functioning. And then a baby is born with severe neurological disorder. Are you willing to say that baby is not human? You see what I'm saying? Okay. Because with severe neurological disorder, that baby is not going to have mental functioning and all of that. But if you're saying that that baby therefore is not human, then you probably should go back and adopt points of views very common in ancient Sparta or Athens that Plato defends, where deformed babies, even after birth, should be just put a cast on the hillside and allowed to die, because they're not good for it's not good for them and it's not good for society. So nobody should take care of deformed babies. Everybody with me? Is it that what we call human is something that has evolved culturally over history as we have begun to have more and more abilities to do different things? If so, then it clearly is not a scientific fact independent of culture. Everybody with me? Okay. In other words, what conceivable contribution does knowing all this biology make to the abortion debate? I guess in a negative way, it does. It does tell you that their science is not telling you a whole lot of what you should do in this case. It's a question of societal politics, and in terms of what do you think about you know, at one end, what do you think about maintaining or giving rights to everything called human? At the other end, to what extent do you think anybody else should be allowed to interfere with what you do with your body, right? But these are not scientific questions. These are questions of politics and ethics. Okay, everybody with me? And these are not even questions of public health, for that matter. It's not a question of vaccination or a question of eugenics or anything like that. These are just, we are not in a position to say anything. Everybody with me? Okay. The other part, of course, part of the reason why I signed this book also is to drive home how miraculous the whole process of development seems to be. And here Scott and I keep on harping on the same old theme, is that all the stuff that makes us human, that it evolved over evolution, does not surprise us. Lots of things can happen over billions of years. The fact that this happens over 9 months is the one that really gets to us, right? You have this cell, that fertilized cell, which unless you have very good eyes, you can't even see with the naked eye. It's much smaller than a grain of sand. If you have very good eyes, you might be able to spot it, right? And eventually it comes out as this fairly rational thing. All kinds of things are in the right place. You have two eyes, they're in the front of the head, right? And things are not even symmetric. If you're male, one testes is slightly bigger than the other. There's an asymmetry, it's all built in. Your heart is on the left side of your body. Everybody with me? Okay. All of these things built in right from the beginning. And it goes on over there, and everything unfolds, which is a bad metaphor to use, as if there's a preordained, in some sense there must be a preordained plan of some kind, in the sense that it unfolds the right way it's supposed to do. In 4 weeks after implantation, you begin to have certain areas out of which a heart will grow, out of which a brain will grow, and things of that sort, all of it. The only thing that takes a long time to really segregate out and begin to grow properly are the gonads. That comes rather late in development. Okay? But long before that, the things that are going to be your reproductive cells get segregated from the other parts of the body and are carefully set aside so there would be no chemical insults. Everything happens over a 9-10 month period. And then you remind yourself you're not special that way. The same thing can be said of all kinds of animals and plants, right? This pattern of development as to what exactly it does and how it does it with very, very rudimentary data. All right, so that's the message. What did people get out of it? Or out of Scott's presentation? I want people to speak up a bit. Anything you get? Anything that surprised you?
Or were there no surprises at all? Is everything so completely obvious? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Let's say you take it as being unproblematic that you should not kill a person, right? And to that extent, even if something is inside your own body, society has some reasonable prerogative to intervene, right? But how do you medically define personhood? When is that thing, whatever it is, the embryo, the embryonic stage, the fetal stage, when does personhood emerge? I mean, even would you have even such consensus that personhood emerges before birth, or is it just after birth? And why birth? After all, brain development does not stop in humans, right? We are, as Scott points out, somewhat like kangaroos, that a lot of our development has after we emerge from the uterus, the difference being in the case of the kangaroos, the pouches are made of skin. And the kangaroos go through a pretty bizarre reproductive process, right? The embryo gets out of the vagina and then has to climb up the mother's body very slowly. Okay, this takes about half an hour sometimes. It's been filmed. And you just hoping nothing happens to it during this process because it slips a bit, it rises. Very painfully it climbs up and gets into the pouch. And then the development continues in the pouch, and that's where the next generation of kangaroos get created. Difference with us is instead of a fold of the skin, it's usually a piece of cloth, right? Some pouch in which the babies are put and more or less carried by somebody or the other during the first couple of years. Should we say personhood only begins at the end of those 2 years? Yeah. I don't think it can. I mean, since you completely come out and ask me to say it, because I'm not sure it can be defined in any sensible way.
Like, the only thing is that, like, okay, we've been going back and forth now, right? Saying, like, okay, this is a human. Oh, no, that's not a human. This is a human. That's not a human. So it's like, we need some sort of, how are we supposed to form policies and legislation and all this kind of stuff? Like, we have no answer at all whatsoever.
I mean, I'll get back. Yeah, do you want to go ahead? Survive by itself or with assisted technology? With assisted. So what are you going to do when you end up with the So what happens in the Brave New World scenario where the whole process from beginning to end is carried out outside the body? The ectogenesis thing, which in some sense still remains an active goal of reproductive scientists, and here's my technological optimism coming out as always, I in some sense approve of, to think that you can completely do that without it having to take place inside a human body. Take the fertilized cell and you essentially grow it to adulthood, or not adulthood, grow it to the status of birth outside the body in the test tube. What happens then? It's a person right from the moment of fertilization?
Well, like, with that definition that every organ needs to function and you need neurally sound, so then are you saying that like people who are like intellectually disabled or they don't have the capability of using a certain organ and then they're not viable by life or they're not a human?
With medical technology combining with it, like say they can't, they don't have an intestine, but they can have like, you know, a little sac or like with medical advances combined,
Well, what about when you have a complete neurological dysfunction?
Well, if once it becomes depends on the parent and all that, we're back to the situation where it really is the case that science can provide no answer whatsoever. And that might well be the best message you can get out of this. Don't try to take social problems, and abortion is a problem of social policy, and try to naturalize them in the sense of try to pretend that they are a scientific question that has a technological answer, and hide behind the technological answer where you should be debating societal values. Okay. I mean, it may well be the case. It may be the case that, okay, the first case that I was going to point out to you was that even the issue of being human and personhood needs to be distinguished, right? A cell I flick off my hand right now, and I'm sure I am, as a nail is touching it. We flick off cells all the time. Is a human cell, right? It is human, but it does not qualify for personhood by any stretch of the imagination. And then you might well have to accept that personhood is too, it's an invented concept by philosophers of a certain kind that has no proper referent. It does not capture anything definite, and you might not be able to answer it. Give up on that. And then get to abortion as a matter of social policy. When does it become, right, clearly an important enough societal prerogative that society can interfere into what it does to the individual? And remember how much society, we don't accept society to interfere. In particular, society hardly interferes with how parents treat their offspring, right? Parental rights are fairly serious. Parents can choose not to vaccinate their children. They can choose by going for homeschooling not to put their children in public schools because very often they don't like the values that society would impart on the children in their schools. We go a long way in terms of giving parental choices, right? So we intervene only when we have to. Even in cases of violence against children, it has to be pretty severe before the state actually intervenes, okay? Probably the standards are too low there, that state should be intervening. Society should be intervening earlier, right? And all of that. And then you come back and you wonder, when is it? When somebody is making a decision that has serious biological, economic, and psychological consequences, and you're going to intervene. And in fact, what it should really drive home to you is that given the nature of the problem, perhaps really most effort should be spent on not getting into situations where you have to address the problem. That is, sex education and universal access to contraception might be a far more important thing to focus on than abortion debates to avoid the hard questions. And if the hard questions become extremely rare, that's a great thing to the situation to be. As does, for example, so far, questions of euthanasia. Yeah, that's another tough one. When should the life support system be shut off? We sort of managed to meander around it because the question arises very, very rarely. If you could get there with respect to abortion, wouldn't that be a healthier situation to be in as a society? Mm-hmm. And in particular, make it so rare that it does not become a political litmus test for people as to what you feel about certain things. Everybody with me? Is that what we should be getting? Look, there's one part of this that I really want to get across is that what Scott has been saying, and I've been saying, and if you disagree with me, you need to give arguments, and I can see people might disagree with me, is that science does not provide an answer to these questions. You cannot hide behind science. And the way in which your book does it is by going through the entire process of fertilization and development and reproduction in a lot of excruciating detail, what happens at each stage. Okay. Any questions? And at the other end, presumably all of you share with me a great disquiet about the idea that just because a baby is born disabled, we should just kill it. It doesn't matter. And it's not human or not a person. That is not acceptable, morally acceptable for us as a society. Everybody with me? So you are getting some parts where I'm saying something definite, but they are, I think, fairly extreme cases. All right. Any more questions? Did you enjoy the book? All right.
I am going to switch to discussions of race in medicine starting Thursday. So there's going to be a shift of gear, but we'll get back to the last part of this book after the break. Just as a reminder as to why I think that's an important thing to discuss, how many of you know RLM, the building? Well, most of you. Who is it named after? And how many of you have heard of how brilliant a teacher he was, Robert Lee Moore, and known for his method of teaching math, where he would try to play the game of Plato with his slave, where the slave is going to discover a theorem just from his questions? Well, Robert Lee Moore is one of the people in this university who refused to teach a class if they were an African-American student. That's part of the legacy. That's why we need to talk about race in this class, in this university. All right, we'll pick it up on Thursday.